This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and what a couple of weeks it has been. What has all this cost? You heard the cost of all this in the voice of our federal worker friend, Marcelo Del Canto.
It really was a wake-up call for what my wife and I both thinking, hey, we both work for the federal government. You know, it's as stable as it gets. And, you know, we were caught a little bit short-sighted, as I'm sure other folks were as well.
So they're vigilant about this happening again. That's the permanent impact of this on that federal worker. But what about political costs, historical costs? In the annals of history, where does this kind of event end up? A conversation later this hour with former Treasury Secretary W. Michael Blumenthal. Also, the notion of bad behavior and life and death this hour, how to inject a sense of consequences into the parallel world of online social media, when the consequences of bullying can be suicide and the police in the real world are simply ignored. That's later this hour. And on a day, really, that's all about redemption in Washington, D.C., perhaps you might say that anyway, we're going to return to some young voices turning away from faith as we continue to examine America, the young nation, less and less under God. But first, on Capitol Hill, is it relief, smiles, tears? Hard to find an emotion just right for this moment.
What we've done is sent a message to Americans from every one of our 50 states, but in addition to that, to the citizens of every country in the world, that the United States lives up to its obligations.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid in remarks yesterday. Maybe he's a bit of a hero. Maybe the American people would want to say, hey, please stop sending us messages, Washington, D.C. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Message received, Todd?
Well, the shutdown is over. The debt limit is lifted for now. What kind of messages did Capitol Hill receive from the rest of the country? That remains to be seen. We could be right back in this movie, John. But for now, crisis averted, I guess.
Well, there were some Democrats speaking yesterday very quickly about how this was a victory and the brinksmanship doesn't work anymore. And as you say, we're going to be here again in February based on this vote. But what about Republicans? What are they saying about this? Is this, we're ready to do it again? Is this a strategy that they've dumped? Is Senator Cruz persona non grata? There's a lot to reexamine here.
That there's a lot of anger towards Senator Cruz, and you saw a parade of Republicans heading onto television yesterday trying to marginalize Cruz, saying what a terrible episode this was. We can try to recover, but we've done so much damage to ourselves. But let's listen to Ted Cruz. If you thought that Ted Cruz was humbled or somehow marginalized in his own mind or by his own base by the episode of the last 2 weeks, take a listen to Ted Cruz here.
We saw the House of Representatives take a courageous stand listening to the American people that everyone in official Washington just weeks earlier said would never happen. That was a remarkable victory.
Are they saying victory over in the House, by and large, among the GOP?
Well, let me play you another congressman, John Fleming, who's from Louisiana. Now, the question for him was, have you all learned that to push the House leadership in this way is a bad idea? Do you think you lost credibility? Do you think the Democrats have the upper hand on you now and that you'll be marginalized? Listen to Fleming.
No, I think it builds credibility because I think Democrats did not think that we would press this. And now they know that we will and that we might do it again.
It's Representative John Fleming, from Louisiana, speaking yesterday. I mean, are they really serious about that? I mean, can they do that? Will Speaker Boehner, for instance, go along with that once more?
And that is the question. Can they do it again? They can sure try. It depends on what strategy the leadership follows. Again, that group that Fleming and Cruz belong to in the House, not Cruz, but Cruz in spirit,
sure,
is about 30 strong. They drove this process on the repeal of Obamacare. There are new budget negotiations that are at least optically starting this very morning when Paul Ryan and Patty Murray, the Senate budget chairman, meet in front of the cameras to show that the big budget negotiation is starting. Can these folks derail it again? They can try. The question is, will Boehner follow them? Listen to Aaron Schock. He's a younger congressman. He's from Illinois, counts himself a moderate. I asked him, hey, what has to change here? What lessons have the Republicans learned from this episode? Should they follow this group of 30 again? Listen to Schock.
From my vantage point, it's become clear that there are certain members who will not be a constructive member of the team. And so we need to recognize that. And I believe build bridges with our friends on the other side of the aisle.
I think it's safe to say there's more than one congressman in shock this morning in the GOP. What do they say, though, specifically about Boehner? Did he get any support yesterday from the folks you talked to?
And here's the big question, because let's go to the vote tally for a second, because it's important. 285 House votes for this deal. Finally, John, only 87 Republicans, nowhere close to a majority of the majority. You've heard of the Hastert rule. They wound up blowing the Hastert rule out of the water on this one. And that's always dangerous territory for a speaker, especially on a high profile vote. 198 Democrats, not a single Democrat in the House or Senate voted against this deal. So then you turn around and you go to the conservatives. Hey, is Boehner in trouble? Do you think that he's not sticking to your values? Listen to Tim Hoolskamp. He's a Tea Party affiliated conservative, not always a friend to the speaker. He's from Michigan. And I asked him if he thought, after all this, Boehner fought for his priorities, or if Boehner was in trouble.
No, in general, I mean, it was what the conservatives wanted to do. And again, when the majority said we're going to do something, he said yes, and he did it. So I was pleased with his response to what most of us wanted to do. So.
And of course, there's no real incentive to do anything. I mean, they don't have to do anything until the end of the Congress. And you know, that's in 2015, I suppose. So Boehner can just kind of squeak along. Let's remind people of the Hastert rule that, as you say, seems to be in flames today. That's the rule whereby nothing will be brought to the floor of the House unless it commands a majority of the Republican votes, right?
Correct. In this case, a majority of the majority is the cliche. And in this case, that means a majority of Republicans at least support it. Boehner has tried to go further than that when he can, which is to say, pass a bill with 217 or 218 Republicans. Don't rely on Democratic votes at all. And in many cases, he's been able to do that to the extent that the House has been able to pass things. But when you do that, John, by definition, what you're getting are ideologically pure votes for your party. And I think Aaron Schock's point there, as a budget negotiation comes along, Schock was trying to say, like, look, I haven't been here a long time, but we can keep passing pure Republican-only bills. But in this world with a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate, we'll just keep staring ourselves in the mirror. So we can marginalize the Flemings and Hoolskamps and Cruises unless they want to change their ways, or we can try to get some like-minded Democrats and move forward. And I think that story hasn't been written yet.
Well, we'll see. I mean, the test of bipartisanship is really going to be made over the next few weeks and months. But, you know, I missed it, but there was a real C-SPAN moment at the end of all this yesterday, right, Todd?
Yeah, there was, John. During the vote to pass the debt limit and shutdown bill, a woman who is named Diane Reedy, she's a House floor reporter. That's also a stenographer, really. She stepped to the microphone at the podium and started yelling into the microphone. And a lot of us in the speaker's lobby off the floor didn't hear her. We just heard the gavel dropping. John, a bunch of floor keepers and guards grabbed Ms. Reedy. She's a 20-year veteran, shuffled her off the floor right past me and into an elevator. It was at that point that I caught some sound of Ms. Reedy, and I want you to listen to this. It shook a lot of people up.
He will not be mocked. He will not be mocked.
Don't touch me.
He will not be mocked. The greatest deception here is this is not one nation under God. It never was. Had it been, it would not have been.
John, that was a moment that got a lot of attention on the internet and on television, and that sound there. Diane Reedy was interviewed by the Capitol Police and then taken to a hospital for a mental health evaluation. We have not heard about her condition.
Well, a surreal ending to a surreal story, to be sure. And again, it must have been stressful for everyone up there. Todd Zwillick, thanks as always.
You bet, John.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Might the framers of the U.S. Constitution be thinking about the events of the past few weeks? Perhaps they would surprise us and say, hey, everything fine. Or maybe they would say what someone with a very long view of Washington and power and global finance has said.
It is really true that our political system is broken.
That's W. Michael Blumenthal, former U.S. Treasury Secretary, author of a new memoir, From Exile to Washington, a memoir of leadership in the 20th century.
I had, when I was in the government twice, we always had big disagreements with the other party. So I was in a Democratic administration. But we were always able to sit down and argue and then make a deal. And this present situation where one part of one party doesn't understand that or doesn't care about it or wants, doesn't want to face reality or doesn't want to deal with facts is very damaging to this country, to lots of individuals who lose their jobs and their income. But above all, it's to the functioning of the democracy. So that needs to be faced.
What do you think it's done to the Treasury? The Secretary of the Treasury was often a position that, you know, was more like a technocrat. You were very much a economic visionary working behind the scenes in the administration, but you certainly didn't have to put out fires like Timothy Geithner or Jack Lew have had to do in this situation, and you rarely had to emerge into the political sphere. It's a different job today.
Yeah. Well, I beg to differ with you a little bit. Secretary of the Treasury of the United States has never been a technocrat in the background, starting with Alexander Hamilton.
Well, Hamilton, he is the exact, that's for sure.
Well, there have been more or less prominent secretaries of the Treasury in the course of U.S. history, but it's after the Secretary of State, the second most senior and most important job in the government, and I certainly had to deal with fires and put them out. I had the good fortune and misfortune, however you want to call it, that I was in that job during the second worst energy crisis of this country, mm-hmm. when OPEC was jacking up prices for oil. We had gas lines. The dollar was taking a beating. This was the period of stagflation, for those old enough to remember.
No, and I am old enough to
remember.
But those were external factors that came in and really caused a crisis. This is so self-created.
Well, it brings us to the central point of my book, which is that it's individuals who make history. Nothing in history is certain until it happens. And things can go in almost any direction depending on who has his hands on the lever of power. If you had a different leader in the House or a different group of leaders in the Republican Party, if you had a different leader, say, in the White House, say, I think very highly of President Obama. He has many great talents. But if Lyndon Johnson, for whom I worked, were in the White House, I think things might be a little different.
Yeah, I think
so individuals matter in this. As in this crisis. And we've had the misfortune that we haven't had the right people. I don't really mean President Obama, but we haven't had the right group of people to tackle this complex problem.
Well, we're going to tackle this issue of leadership from a different perspective. I'm talking with W. Michael Blumenthal, former Treasury Secretary, author of the memoir From Exile to Washington, a memoir of leadership in the 20th century. A look at leadership when we return. Secretary, stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We found ourselves lucky to have former Treasury Secretary Michael Blumenthal in our studio on the day this latest political crisis in Washington ended. His view of Washington goes back to the 1950s, where he worked his way up at the State Department to become a U.S. ambassador advising on trade matters at the White House and the United Nations, before heading up the Treasury Department during some of the worst financial crises of the 20th century. It's a story that begins with a man as powerless as one could be after World War II, and the remarkable story of learning that in the end, real leadership is the thing that matters most in world affairs.
The emotions are first of all one of enormous gratitude, because it is true, was true, perhaps a bit less so this now, that this was still the land of opportunity. I came with $60 in my pocket. I landed in San Francisco in 1947, And 14 years later, I was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State. And 16 years later, I was a United States ambassador representing the President of the United States. No country in the world would have given me that opportunity. Now, some of it is good fortune. Luck is always a factor in this. I happen to know a guy who was working for President Kennedy, who knew me, had studied with me at Princeton, and who opened a door for me to get in, but also just simply the fact that I could get an education. I came with a 10th grade education. First thing I did was to be smart enough to figure out I better get some more schooling, and went to eventually the University of California at Berkeley, which in those days I could do for $35 a semester. Mm. Nowadays, it'd be several thousand. So the opportunity was there. So that, first of all, it was that feeling. Then that feeling of enormous satisfaction of finally having a say. I had been kicked around. There were forces there that caused my life to move in one direction or another without my understanding why. Finally, to have a say of them, in control of my own life. Be grateful to this country for giving me that opportunity, and then really try to work hard to make something of myself. And then when it happened, enormous satisfaction. I won't deny it. Obviously, there's pride, there's ego involved, there's pride that you've done something with yourself. But then the question always arose, what are you going to do with this opportunity? Are you going to do a better job than all those people whom you observed, who ran the government in China very poorly and caused inflation, caused alarmist poverty? Can you do it better? When you are in a company or running a company, can you run the company in a way that pays attention to the people that you're responsible for? And both in my private industry jobs as well as in the government, I tried to learn from that and to apply it. Didn't always do it well, but I tried. Mm.
You know, I'm thinking about that opportunity. I'm thinking today. And I'm trying to imagine myself as you in 1947 landing in San Francisco with I guess I'd probably rather have $600 today than $60 in my pocket.
Multiply by 10. That's okay. Yeah.
If you had landed today, if you found yourself in that situation just starting out today, do you think those opportunities exist anymore? Do you think the extent of the opportunity to get the education and to make it the way that you made it even exists today in America?
Well, for some people, there's always opportunity. Just think of the ones who invent some electronic gadget and go from nothing to billionaire. That can still happen. But for the kind of person who comes in the situation that I came in, it's much more difficult. It's much more difficult because in the early post-war years, the United States was the only major economic world power. There was opportunity everywhere. The country was booming to retool itself after the end of the war, full of returning veterans, all eager to do things, my fellow students in Berkeley and eventually in graduate school. Things were cheap. Yes, there were arguments. People didn't like President Truman very much in those days. And he was beginning to tackle the racial problems we had in this country, civil rights and so forth. But there was opportunity, as I said. I could. It was easy for me, relatively, to go to school during the day and work at night or on vacations and to earn enough to keep going and put myself through school, at least in the beginning until graduate school. That's all very much more difficult. And I watch my own children, they struggle more than we do. So it's harder now.
Are leaders more important now?
Leaders are always important. How can I say more important when I think how my life's been affected by Adolf Hitler? A very, very bad leader, to put it mildly.
Although with the opportunity eroded, there's less margin for error. It's more important that someone, particularly in the United States, really take the hand of power and do something with it.
I would say, in fairness to people in charge, it's more complex. It's more difficult. The world has become more complex. It's more interrelated. In those days, what the United States wanted to do, it could do without too much reference to other countries. Of course, always other countries. But after, in the post-microchip era, I would say, The United States is just one. It's the biggest factor, but just one factor in a very complex interrelated system. And the control that leaders have over the destiny of their country is clearly more limited than it has to be. You need to be much more alert to what goes on in the rest of the world. You'll have to look for allies much more than you did before. And even in your own country, technology has given us many, many gifts, but it's also complicated our lives.
W. Michael Blumenthal, former Treasury Secretary, author of the new memoir, From Exile to Washington, a memoir of leadership in the 20th century. Thanks so much.
Welcome. Nice to be with you.
Our conversation on the parallel universe of online social media and the real world has become your conversation. Rules of conduct in one don't apply to the other. Hugh from Oklahoma City?
We have a 13-year-old son. You know, we've had a discussion with him about the appropriateness of what should happen on social media, but we also try and balance that with his growing sense of privacy and responsibility.
Consequences we take for granted in the real world may be irrelevant to lurkers on Facebook and Twitter and Ask FM. We'd love to know your story on this subject. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number, and there's much more at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The players in Washington who did not lose their jobs during the government shutdown, of course, lawmakers, that's who I'm speaking of, will spend the next several weeks, no doubt, looking at the polling data that both parties will be conducting, as well as independents and the usual polling suspects. Americans are not happy with the shutdown. Duh. But who do they blame? Right now, and when we revisit all of this in a few months' time, apparently. Gary Langer is the president of Langer Research Associates, a nonpartisan polling group that directs polling for ABC News. Gary, welcome.
Thank you, John.
So the early numbers are not great for whom?
Well, pretty consistently poor, particularly for the Republicans in Congress, but not cheerful for anyone involved. Americans don't like kamikaze politics, and this is showing clearly in the data. I mean, the president has a majority disapproval rating for handling it, although just barely 53%. The Democrats in Congress, 61%. But the Republicans have a 74% disapproval rating for handling the situation, and that's increased more sharply than either of the others over the past 2 weeks.
The shutdown in the 90s turned Newt Gingrich into a real sort of campaign icon, a brand to run against. Has that happened to any individual in this case, as far as you can tell, Ted Cruz, John Boehner, the like?
Well, I think the Tea Party has declined in popularity more generally, and to the extent that candidates are associated with the Tea Party, it'll be a negative for those who see the party negatively, which is an increasing population. However, the Congress, of course, is so balkanized in gerrymandered congressional districts, it could be a positive as well as rather than a negative for many. Well, of them. So
let's
hard
explore
to see
that.
How it plays out politically. But, you know, historically, in many ways, John, we've seen this movie before. After the shutdowns in 1995 and 96, then President Clinton's approval rating was almost exactly the same for handling it as Barack Obama's is now. The Republicans in Congress disapproval was precisely the same as it is now. Yet a year later, in the 1996 election, it didn't seem to make that much difference. The president was reelected. The Republicans held Congress.
And let's explore the district point that you made, which is really the fascinating point, that you can look at the numbers here and nationally see an anger at very, very strident, ideologically based politics on the left and the right, but on the right in this case. But you can take those numbers into conservative gerrymandered districts and basically run on the negatives.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So what matters in these cases for many of these members of Congress are the attitudes not nationally, but in their individual districts. And look, this is why we customarily see 90 or more, usually more, percent of House incumbents reelected when they choose to run. The gerrymandering of these districts is really, in many ways, I think, responsible for the balkanization of politics and the disputes that we see in Washington. It is clearly frustrating to the American public. There's broad disapproval, again, particularly directed at the Republicans, but in general, disaffection with politics and with the way the system's working. And I think that the shutdown we've just been through and the gamesmanship, brinksmanship over the debt ceiling is a good example of the result.
Finally, I can't resist. The GOP seems to have given up on the idea of taking the Senate in 2014, but could the Democrats take the House? Matt Drudge suggested that.
It's really hard to imagine. You know, again, what's mattered here is not simply where public attitudes now, and they're critical, chiefly of the Republicans for the shutdown we just experienced, but where they go in the future as we move closer to the midterm elections. If the economy is not seen to have been badly damaged, if we get through this and move ahead, then experience suggests that it may not have lasting impacts on the races in the midterms.
Back to the future of the mid-90s. Gary Langer, thanks so much.
You bet, John.
Gary Langer is the president of Langer Research Associates, a nonpartisan polling group that directs polling for ABC News. You know, folks, one of the real tangible winners in this Washington, D.C. affair might be Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell up for re-election in his state of Kentucky. Turns out the deal struck between Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Minority Leader McConnell secures close to $3 billion in funding for one of Senator McConnell's pet projects, a dam on the Ohio River, something that he might be running on in his contested election. Philip Bailey, political editor at WFPL, has been reporting on this story from Louisville. Philip, what's going on here?
Hey, how you doing? Well, essentially, you know, this legislation, there's a provision in it specifically that allows for the increase for the Olmsted Dam and Lock project from $755 million in funding, and it raises that authorization cap to $2.9 billion. That is actually the largest increase of many different, which we would call pork spending, in that legislation. So it caught many by surprise to see in the midst of the shutdown and default debate to catch this provision in there where you see this significant increase for a project in Senator McConnell's home state.
Is your view here, and is the view from Louisville, that Harry Reid did Senator McConnell a favor, or did Senator McConnell really just sort of extract a concession because he needs to run on bringing money back to the district or back to the state?
Senator McConnell's office has said to us that they did not ask for this request. They said that, you know, Senator Dianne Feinstein and Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee are the ones responsible for this language, that the senator did not request this. However, he has been a vocal supporter of this project in the past. Back in 2009, he was actually at the dam encouraging for additional funding that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers were asking for. It's a key project not only for the state of Kentucky but for the region. About $90 billion tons of goods actually go through that dam, like coal, petroleum, grain, in fact. So it's pretty important to the region. But the senator, surprisingly, isn't trying to take credit for all of this. He's saying, you know, this wasn't something that I requested. It was something that was put in by these other senators that has bipartisan agreement.
Well, he's a very smooth operator, and Feinstein and Lamar Alexander working on his behalf is certainly not out of the question. But let's not be conspiratorial here, Philip Bailey. Let's talk about McConnell's challenger. Does he run on the question of, you know, needless federal spending? Does he dare go after this earmark?
I suspect that Matt Bevin, who is Senator McConnell's primary challenger in the Republican primary, will. I was a bit surprised at the fact that Mr. Bevin did not address this issue last night when the story first broke. His campaign spokesman said that they will address this issue in the coming days. But, you know, for the McConnell campaign, I think as Senator McConnell, as he struck this deal with Senator Reid, he's looking to the general election. The McConnell campaign considers Matt Bevin to be more of a nuisance. They consider him to be someone who's still stuck at 20%. His campaign fundraising totals weren't that impressive, about $822,000 raised, $600,000 of which were Mr. Bevin's from his personal wealth. It's yet to be seen if Bevin can actually crack that and provide a serious insurgency. However, it is problematic for McConnell in the sense that every time he makes any sort of larger compromise or deal with the Democrats, right here back home, he has to deal with Bevin and Tea Party activists who say he's not being conservative enough. This new information about this provision in the bill for the Olmsted Lock and Dam could turn a lot of conservatives off and energize Bevin's base. We'll see in the next few days and weeks if that benefits Bevin or not.
All right, last thing. And here's the big headline. I know you're not an economist, but Philip Bailey, maybe the price of avoiding a multi-trillion dollar financial calamity of a debt default by the United States was a cool $3
billion. I mean, it seems that way in a lot of people's minds. When you look at the shutdown bill, there were a lot of different provisions that were added in there. Senator John McCain of Arizona, I believe, commented last night on this story, saying that, you know, he feels like the politicians in Washington are basically alcoholics, so they can't help themselves when it comes to putting this spending in there.
Well,
this is something that obviously the Tea Party wanted to get rid of, but we still see this sort of practice in Washington.
$3 billion to avoid a few trillion in calamity sounds like a bargain to me. Philip Bailey, thanks so much.
No problem.
Philip Bailey is political editor at WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. The online world, a world where brutal honesty is encouraged, where insults are rewarded, where there's no fear of reprisal when you tell someone they are worthless. And oh, right, maybe a few people end up killing themselves because they just couldn't take it. Listening to me say that makes you cringe, right? That attitude is horrifying in normal, rational conversation. Even now, it produces feelings of remorse. I want to apologize. I'm so sorry. Can I make things right? These inhibitors, these notions of consequences, are totally absent from the world which motivated 12-year-old Rebecca Ann Sedgwick of Lakeland, Florida, to kill herself. A story you may have heard about, another casualty of online bullying. Local police say there are consequences. Two young women, aged 14 and a 12-year-old, have been charged with aggravated stalking. That's a third-degree felony.
What you're doing is you're setting up a circumstance for them to collect a felony record and possibly, depending on the set of circumstances, go to jail or prison for a very long period of time.
That's Sheriff Grady Judd at a news conference in Winter Haven, Florida. Joining us is Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Slate and a fellow at Yale Law School. She's the author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Intervening in this brutal bullying conversation, Bazelon says, has a lot to do with putting yourself in the social media world and little to do with what the police might do in the real world if you get caught.
We worry that kids go online and they can sometimes adopt these brasher, harsher personas and say things they would never say in real life. And, you know, obviously that's something adults do too.
Sure.
So you're asking, okay, when kids are on social media sites doing things which are cruel and can be harmful, how do adults even know they're there? And this is a huge challenge for parents especially, right? Because we didn't grow up with this kind of access ourselves, and we're often feeling a step behind our own teenagers. I think the most important opportunity is when your kids first enter into this world. So what I say to my own kids as they're lobbying to get onto social media, because I have a teenager, I would not open the door of my house in New Haven at midnight and say to my son, you know, go explore the city. I hope it goes well for you. I hope you live out the values I've imparted to you. And in the same way, I would not tell him to enter into this online new world by himself. I want to be there guiding him in the beginning, making sure that he understands how to use it responsibly.
Although, of course, there are a lot of parents who didn't intervene in the beginning, and there is a world out there that's already sort of up and running. And I guess if we think of it as a parallel world, kind of like your metaphor of going outside and exploring the city and good luck with that kind of thing. I mean, in the city, in the real world, there are real police who, you know, who monitor behavior. There are constraints within our society that have been built up over a long, long period of time. Does that argue for basically a set of constraints within the digital world on some level that makes it more like the real world where there are police out there? It's not just some customer service issue on Yahoo where if you say a bad word, somebody's going to de-spam you. That there has to be a much more responsible idea of how we regulate behavior online because it is an actual world.
I agree. And I think that the social media companies have a bigger responsibility than they are living up to here to do the kind of policing you're talking about. You know, they all have rules against bullying and harassment. The problem is enforcing those rules. And the way American law works, we don't give these sites any legal responsibility to go out and make sure these are places where, in terms of kids' social welfare, they feel safe.
So let me run this by you as a law school professor. In one of these cases of suicide, these recent cases of suicide, one of the internet responses among people who apparently had no particular concern about anyone reading this said, yes, ick, I know, I bullied Rebecca and she killed herself. You know, no big deal. There were other acronyms in there that were more obscene than that. Does that constitute assault if we were wandering around the world and actually said that in a public restaurant?
I honestly read that post more as a sad cry for help and a feeling of guilt and shame and defensiveness. But maybe what you're also asking is, should there be consequences? And I think, yes, when kids are really cruel online, there should be consequences. What I question is whether the criminal justice system is really the place for those consequences, whether bringing felony charges against a 12 and 14-year-old to set an example, because that's really what's going on here, whether that is really fair and makes sense.
Well, I fairness, I don't know, but makes sense. I agree. The whole criminal justice system weighing in here feels like a message from Mars that in a sense, we regulated the communications industry, television and radio, in terms of content when those technologies emerged. Here, it's not about content. It's about behavior and activity. This is an electronic domain that needs a fundamentally different idea of regulation if it's going to be able to coexist with our society.
Right. So we have three levers we can pull here. We have laws. We could change our laws and try to regulate more. Then there's the architecture of the web. Are there things we could do to send kids warnings? Or could there be an algorithm that could pick up the kind of cruelty you are talking about and then maybe not even prevent kids from posting, but just say, hey, do you really want to share this message with 400 people? And then there's social norms, which can be incredibly powerful.
Very powerful.
And right now, I think we're just in the middle of a wave of really trying to get kids to think about bullying online and offline and how they can make it not socially acceptable.
I think the thing that interests me, and it just occurred to me in what you were saying, is that, you know, the Edward Snowden case is an object lesson here in the sense that, okay, fine, so the government's going to observe behaviors that are related to national security. Maybe that technology would be more useful in creating some of these kinds of warning signs, social sort of inhibitors, to just encourage people that when they're online and behaving in a passionate, emotional way, that there are consequences.
I would rather see private companies develop those kinds of tools. The idea of the government doing it is a little too big brother for me. And
yeah,
I think that has that problem to it. But I completely understand your impulse here. You're basically grasping for a way to make this world more parallel to the real world in that people are watching what kids are doing and trying to protect them and make sure they understand that there can be consequences for doing things that are wrong.
Well, it's a great conversation, and I think, you know, more people than just parents need to have it, that's for sure. Emily, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Slate, fellow at the Yale Law School, author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
What is the path from God to know God? The questions and challenges to faith are as old as the story of Abraham in the Bible. But the path from God to know God is a journey many young Americans are taking. This young American nation is increasingly not under God, according to surveys which show a large number, 1 in 4 of the so-called millennials, to be unaffiliated with the spiritual path of their parents. We've heard stories of this all week long. Today, voices on the path from a Christian upbringing to the embrace of no God. Emily Peterson from Boston, Daniel Munoz from Texas, and Amber Van Atten from New York City all have made different journeys to end up in the same place. For Emily, it started with a very traditional mainline Christian denomination.
I was brought up as a Lutheran Christian in Delaware, and my family is still very religious. I was pretty religious growing up, too. And as an adolescent, I realized I had a lot of questions. And at one point in my development, I told myself, well, you know, this is the brain God gave me, and it is curious, and it wants to understand. And I came to realize that I didn't actually have a belief in God anymore.
Daniel Munoz, your story.
Well, I was raised Catholic in the heart of Texas, and against everything my parents wanted, I ended up losing faith when I was maybe 13 or 14, as I learned more about science and philosophy and started to feel like Christianity didn't make sense to me anymore.
And Amber Van Atten, what's your trajectory?
I was raised in a sort of vaguely religious family. We went to a Presbyterian church, and then my mom had a near-death experience and became sort of this really radical born-again Christian almost overnight when I was 9 or 10 years old. And basically forced my entire family to convert. And I was young enough that I sort of went along with it for a while. But then as I got a little bit older, I started to understand how restrictive it was, particularly towards women. And then I really quickly sort of just decided that this wasn't for me. And then it sort of became a big thing, and I ended up leaving my family because my mom told me I was going to hell, and she couldn't handle me not believing.
All right.
There's something I was wondering.
Go ahead, Daniel.
About from your experience, do you think that your parents were more upset because you didn't believe in God anymore? Or do you think the other issues that kind of revolve around it, like gay marriage and birth control, were more important?
You know, honestly, I don't know. I do think that not believing in God thing is important, obviously, to them. But I do think my mother in particular is very socially conservative, and she's very wrapped up in that whole right-wing radio scary place. And so it's so strange to me because she's my mother and I love her, and she has very kind elements to her. But then this other side is just, I think a lot of it is based in ignorance and lack of exposure to culture and different people.
That's a really interesting point. And I think that's that same mechanism is why so many people, you know, my age feel differently about atheism than they used to. Because now you can go on the internet. You can hear what atheist thinkers have to say. You can be involved in a virtual community of atheists, and you can see that we don't have horns. You know, we're not crazy.
Emily?
I completely agree, and I think that the reason that the attitude is culturally shifting has a lot to do with visibility and with the stigma. And the more silent people were about their non-belief, the more shameful it was to be outed as a non-believer.
You start to wonder if the rise in the nuns is really a bunch of people changing their minds, or really people finally feeling like it's safe for them to speak their minds.
You know, the revolutions down through the last couple of millennia that relate to religion, religious denominations, and the upheavals that have taken place in monotheism almost exclusively are a tension between the social rituals of a religious group and people's personal identity with God. Are you three taking it a step further and saying, I don't need a relationship with God, I certainly don't need a relationship with the church, and kind of just all of you leave me alone? Amber?
Personally, I think that my goal is to sort of just be the best person I can be on a day-to-day basis, and that's the most I can sort of contribute to the world.
Daniel?
I think people in my group know that religion offers people some very valuable things, but there's a lot of stuff we disagree with. In fact, you know, personal relationship with God, even the rituals. So we're trying to find the parts of religion that we do see as valuable, like communion, brotherhood, sisterhood, and keep that, but get rid of the superstition and the stuff that we think is morally unacceptable.
Emily?
I actually agree with a lot of what Daniel's saying. I found a lot of positivity in my church community growing up, and I was reluctant to walk away from that when I realized I no longer shared the supernatural beliefs. But in Boston, I found my humanist community and feel a sense of belonging.
Any values, any models that are of interest to you, or are you looking for a fundamentally new way?
A little bit of both. I think most of us kind of consider it sort of a buffet style of pick and choose the different aspects of previous religious traditions. So one, for example, we have weekly gatherings and a lot of times we'll share food and we'll have like a potluck brunch or bring things to share with the community. And that's just such a great non-religious but a community sort of bonding experience.
Amber, where have you gone in the buffet, if at all?
I sort of align very closely with a lot of Buddhist principles and have found a lot of solace and completeness in my life through meditation and yoga. I think there are some good principles in Christianity as well, but none of the, you know, shaming and exclusiveness.
And Daniel, how about you? What models are attractive to you well outside your Catholic faith?
Well, I don't eat at the religious buffet when it comes to morality. I don't even eat in the same restaurant. I mean, I really do think Christians are, by and large, very good people, but I think Christian morality fundamentally gets morality wrong. So why should you treat people well? Well, I mean, because you have a duty to, because of social contract, human dignity, whatever, but not because someone told you to, even if that someone is God. So I look for inspiration to secular ethicists. I think we need to really start fresh and think about what makes life valuable in totally new terms.
Daniel Munoz from Texas, Emily Peterson from Boston, and Amber Van Natten from New York City. So, one of you from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, wrote us, "Faith has been the rock of my family. My church family had been the best constant through immigration and integration here. I've become stronger as a Christian as I grow older."
I'm a millennial and now consider myself agnostic. I think from a lot of people that are still religious, they think, you know, what do we have to live for if we don't believe in something? I really cherish life and every experience and every friendship because, you know, for me and for us, this is it. This is our life, and we need to really appreciate the beauty while we have it.
Raised Jewish, married to an atheist, raising our children is Jewish because, one, atheists have no good holidays. But the Jewish part that we're raising them in is the same part that my husband agrees with as an atheist, which is it doesn't matter what you believe in. It matters how you treat people.
We want you to be a part of the conversation. And tomorrow we'll talk to Krista Tippett, the host of On Being, a radio show that takes up these big questions around religion and spirituality in our daily life. Krista will help us tie together all the stories we've heard this week. Secular Jews, first-generation Muslim Americans, atheists from a Christian background. You can join the conversation tomorrow afternoon also in a live web chat with Lisa Pierce, professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina, specializing in young people and religion. Join us on thetakeaway.org. I'll be there with your questions. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.